There have only been four individuals in Missouri history who have served two consecutive terms as governor. One of them is Jay Nixon. The Democratic statewide official has made an indelible mark in politics and public policy. And now he's thinking about his legacy after 8 years in the biggest office in the state. The Jefferson County native joins us on a very special edition of Politically Speaking.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5-ish, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think that is fair
as
to
I say.
Say
hands to kiss and babies to shake. But
I think my record speaks for itself.
It's a really good question.
Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio today is
colleague Joe Manis.
And our special guest, at least the second or third most famous politician ever to come out of Jefferson County, first being Bill Bradley, second being the late Ron Casey. We have as our special guest today
Governor Jay Nixon.
We are, and I mean this sincerely, sir, we are very honored that you decided to talk with us today.
Yeah, so this will be especially long, so people who use this weather on the treadmill, be prepared.
I'll try to allow you to complete your workout here. I'll talk really slow and see if you get an extra couple miles in.
Well, you used to be a good basketball player. I know that you've had knee surgery, so your dreams of playing in the NBA have been dashed. But from what I've heard from Joe and others, you were pretty fierce and competitive as a basketball player.
Well, I mean, I played a lot, I played competitively later on in life. I mean, I did pretty well with my body until I was about 40 years old, had somebody fall on my knee in a Special Olympics benefit game, and that began a series of knee surgeries that led to both my knees being replaced about a year ago.
Yeah. So what are you doing in the last couple of months? You're going to be out of office, I think, after early January. Give our listeners a sense of what a governor in your situation does kind of at this point in their term.
Well, first of all, there's 73 days left, and that's not an and we, at the beginning of the year, I started putting on each one of my memos how many days were left, not because it's like a sentence you're ending, but we want to remain focused and get things done.
Right.
I pledged to Missourians that I would work as hard the last 100 days as I did the first 100 days. I think Missourians share a value of finishing things, and so I'm really committed to that. This week, for example, we've been doing our Safer, Stronger tour around the state to talk about emergency management, to talk about the things we've done. Yesterday, we were in St. Joseph to talk about the levees that were rebuilt and how important that is. And we were at a faith-based roundtable where we have organized all of those groups. Before that, the day before, we were in Sykeston to deal with our interoperability of our radios now in law enforcement. 1,147 agencies hooked up to that system. About $87 million we spent over the last 8 years to set that system up and make it so we were able to do from a parking lot in Sedalia, in Sykeston, talk to folks all across the state, at hospitals, at police stations, and whatnot. So the bottom line is that's a good example of laying out what we're doing. Today, I've already been out to Monsanto where we cut the ribbon on the new $400 million facility there. I'm speaking at noon to the Bi-State Economic Development Luncheon. I'll finish this evening out at Wentzville Holt, where they're hosting the Project Lead the Way teacher training. We've moved from fewer than 100 schools of Project Lead the Way to almost 600 now, something we've been working on a long time. And then we've got a lot of economic development things that we're continuing to do. I'll be going to Germany relatively soon to meet with the CEO of Bayer. Yesterday met with the CEO of Boehringer Ingelheim Vetmedica on the western side of the state on some economic development things. So you keep working on the economic development side.
So kind of a typical lazy day at the end of the term. I remember the last day of veto session when you had your press conference. You could barely hide your glee about the fact that you wouldn't be having to deal with the General Assembly, at least not in a block. I mean, for the last two. I mean, does that make it freer for you because you can now do all these things that you really want to get done before
the
end?
Well, I'm 73 days away from getting my First Amendment rights back, which will be fun too. I mean, I'll be able to cut loose just a little bit more. But I just think that the veto session was, some of the stuff, it got partisan.
Yes.
I mean, I think some of the votes folks weren't, and that's why I asked the press and a lot of other people to read the veto messages, because on some of those bills, you know, when the House is talking about overriding you to take away protections that we have to get employers to sign up for E-Verify,
right,
so
right.
we know whether folks are legal or illegal or not. And at the same time, their nominee is saying we should build a wall and keep everybody out, yet Republicans here are voting to do that. I mean, I think some of the stuff got so political that the frustration level was not that they have the right to do that sort of stuff, but it was kind of a little bit of the lack of full thought, I think, into what their votes meant.
Now, and before we get into your retrospective stuff, I believe you have bought a house in University City. I've even been told by some people that you or Georgianne are walking your dog around that part of St. Louis.
Yeah, when we're there, the dog refuses to stay inside at all times. So we've had to break it out.
Why did you decide to relocate there? Why didn't you decide to go back to like DeSoto or Jefferson County or something like that?
Well, I mean, it's a good community. It's centrally located in the region. Has access to some things that I'm sure I'll be involved in my next career. And so we wanted, you know, you're relatively near the airport there.
You're close to WashU.
You're close to WashU. You're close to the airport. It's a good central location. And while I have 50% of the stock in the choice, I have 49% of the voting rights.
Hey, that sounds good.
That's fair.
That's fair. I've been married 40 years. I know how that goes.
No, it's we lived in an older house in Jeff City when I was Attorney General. We like kind of older houses and mature neighborhoods where you can walk and trees. And we were joking. We felt a little like Mitt Romney. We felt like the trees are the right size there, you know.
So does your old house in Jeff City I mean, does that become like a historic site because you used to live there?
It was already, right when we left, they made it a Jefferson City Historic Landmark. Harry Truman used to come there when that house was owned by the Cook family, the bankers. And back in the day, Harry Truman would come by and play poker in the back room there.
Wow.
What they called the Florida Room.
You have a plaque there in the back room?
No, you can still kind of smell cigar smoke.
Yeah, he did use cigars.
So, regardless of who wins the next governor's race, whether it's Koster or Greitens, is their current residence going to become a historical landmark, like Koster's apartment in Jefferson City or something like that?
We'll see. I don't know. I think our house is historic in Jeff City, not because of me, but because it was built a long time ago before the and it had. But if folks want to go by and look at a house, they can do that.
Well, one of the things that I thought is that has been noticeable while you've been busy being governor, you haven't been, at least not overtly, busy on the campaign trail. I mean, you're not running. Mm-hmm. President Barack Obama is unusually busy right now. I've never seen a president that busy trying to help, I mean, an outgoing president trying to help mm-hmm. a successor in modern memory. But in your case, is there a particular reason why you decided not to be out there campaigning for people? I mean, was there?
I think there's a couple of things. First of all, I'm staying in close contact with all of especially our senior candidates. I'm on the talk to them and giving advice and taking questions and working with them.
Democrats,
certainly, yeah.
Sorry,
and staying in touch with folks. Obviously, we've got a number of folks that I've worked with that are involved in the Clinton campaign, whether it's Orenscher or Channing Ansley and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
So we stay in very close contact with what's going on out there. But I did make a constructive decision that my job this year was to continue to lead the state through this. And I think it's especially powerful and important during a kind of a contentious election to have a governor that's continuing to move the state forward, continuing to focus on nonpartisan matters, on the things that I do. And plus, when you have the numbers we have in the state, it's kind of the habit I've gotten into of trying to work with folks. And it's quite frankly, the substance of this position is more challenging and interesting than the politics.
Plus, you've been running in statewide elections since 1988. With no break, and you also ran in 1998 during a midterm election. I mean, you can take an election off every now and then.
Yeah, I mean, George, when we went to the polls in August, I mean, Georgianne and I voted at different times, but when we came home, we both had this kind of good feeling that my name went on the ballot. I mean, it was just kind of a liberating feeling. But I ran for state senate in 86, U.S. Senate in 88, re-election in 90, AG in 92, re-election in 96, Senate in 98. Re-election in 2000. So I mean, I've gotten more votes than anyone cumulative, anybody in the history of our state. So I mean, I've done my piece out there. And the other thing is, especially in the bigger races here with senator and governor, you've got really good candidates on our side that are new, and the state needs to hear their voices. And these are jobs that people need to get comfortable with your voice, and you know who you are. They need to feel like what's important to you. Especially for governor, third party verifiers or other politicians saying good things about a candidate just doesn't have the same effect.
Well, there have been times, I mean, we had a conversation a month or two ago. You were a little upset with what the attorney general said about school funding. So,
well, he was wrong. So I said that he was wrong. I mean, we didn't have a crisis. We've got $400 million more in school funding for K-12 than when I became elected, and we've made that a key priority. I do think the legislature made a mistake by lowering the target for the foundation formula, but I just, when he said that, I just.
Well, I want to ask more generally, because I know you're not supporting Eric Greitens. I know you want Chris Koster to be
Absolutely.
Governor. And this has been a point that I've been trying to make since 2012 or 2013. Even though he switched parties, he still retained a number of fairly conservative positions that are different from you.
We're talking about Koster.
We're talking about Koster. And I'm not just talking about guns or until like 3 months ago campaign finance, but like agriculture policy. I would say that you have vetoed a number of bills that you think are giving too much power to corporate ag or big ag. He's been endorsed by the Farm Bureau and many commodity groups.
I was endorsed by commodity groups also.
Yeah,
so I mean, my relationship
with
that sort
that.
Of stuff. The differences of opinion I've had been on basically fiscal policy.
Right.
The bill this year to give a retroactive $45 million tax break in the agriculture when instead we should be using that money on education. I just thought that was the wrong policy.
Yeah.
So I think the bill this year that shifted. I mean, the responsibility if your cattle get loose. I think if you're a farmer and your cattle get loose. And the neighbor hits it, that you should be responsible for keeping your cattle. And why they want to change the law to say that if you have a cow and it gets out, it's the responsibility of the person that hits it with the car. I just don't think that's good policy.
Yeah, I think the point I was trying to ask is, I know that again, you want Koster to be governor, but are you comfortable with all of his positions? That's going to not only be good for Missouri, but maybe even secure part of your legacy.
Well, I mean, everybody's entitled to run on what they say, and he's been clear in a lot of these positions, unlike his opponent. Which is why we're talking about his positions and why we're very generally talking about some other guy that might be running against him who has completely avoided the necessity of actually having detailed plans. So the bottom line is that Chris and I agree about some things. We disagree about other things. But he brings the experience and the knowledge, and I have a full confidence that he can do a tremendous job. My legacy is people working together and moving the state forward economically. My legacy is rebuilding the manufacturing base of this state. My legacy is protecting voters' rights. My legacy is making sure that we're fighting for schools, K-12 and higher education. And I think in those swing zones and in the mental health arena, I think in all those vital, important swing zones, that a Governor Koster would continue on the tremendous progress that I've been involved in.
Now, for more than 20 years, you have been an advocate of campaign donation limits. And I was in Washington in the late 90s when you argued before the Supreme Court.
Successfully.
Yes. I remember.
I may have to use my law license again.
But I remember that day well for whatever reason. But now we've got
a Frank Fahrenkrop sitting in the front row?
Yes.
He was chair of the RNC at the time. Yeah, it was then to see him at the debates is interesting.
And so then, we've got Amendment 2 on the ballot, but there's some flaws in it that Jason and I have talked about numerous times.
The thing that I brought up a lot, and maybe you can address this, I know that Democrats like yourself want campaign donation limits, so they're probably going to support this. But the fact that there's no limits on local and county offices, that just seems like a avenue for people to open up those types of committees, raise unlimited money, and use it to their benefit.
It's exactly the excuse that has stopped us from making incremental change. We need to make some progress. Why sign some of the ethics bills this year that aren't perfect? Mm-hmm. 6 month revolving door is not going to solve the complete problem. Some of the gift things that we dealt with aren't going to solve the complete problem. But boy, it's 70% of Missourians voted for campaign limits, mm-hmm. and and we need to, and they're going to support this. These limits are going to pass. There are some challenges with this, both in how money is accounted for and which committees count and all that sort of stuff. Yes. It's not. It's but boy, oh boy, to say that you got to have the perfect ethics bill, you're always going to have money involved in politics. People have First Amendment rights, but we need to. The one thing that I argued strongly at the United States Supreme Court and won when people didn't think we could is that you can limit the amount of dollars to a candidate committee. Mm-hmm. Okay, from an individual.
Yeah.
Two bad things are happening because we don't have those limits. Number one, the corrosive efforts, corrosive things that happen when people assume government's not doing their best interest.
Right.
It builds cynicism. And number two, for politicians running, they're not doing the meat and potatoes type of thing that you used to have to do. I mean, when I ran for governor, I chose the style to do it this way. We did a lot of $25 a head events, $50 a head events.
Yes,
we went all over the state. So you guys cover some of them. Those things are a thing of the past. And so the same thing for state reps. Somebody will just wire transfer them $50,000, and they don't go to the ham and bean feeds. Maybe they don't even go to the school board meetings. Quite frankly, sometimes they don't show up to ribbon cuttings of factories in their districts. The bottom line is that it's making them less that part of politics, raising the money, is part of the process. And when you take away that as a responsibility, it makes folks not have a full picture.
I just got to point this out before Joe asks a question. This current governor's race, because I just did a story at NPR for this, is more expensive than the next two competitive governor's races combined. And it's probably even maybe double that total amount, because they said that right now it's $50 million. I think it's going to be $70 or $80 million by the time. Is that has to be unfathomable to you, because that wasn't expensive for either of your campaigns.
I appreciate you did that. You said that, but the big states aren't about this year. So, I mean, you're not competing in California, New
Correct.
York,
right.
Florida.
That's
so,
true.
So, I mean,
we're competing with North Carolina and Indiana, right, which are similar size.
So, I mean, but the governor's unique. You have 30 some odd races one time and, you know,
exactly.
eight the other. So,
right.
But still, so while you're correct, but if you're going to fact check Joe,
I understand. Continue.
But I think.
I'm not a person that believes that how much cumulatively is spent in the elections is the worst problem. I think how much money comes directly to candidates
from one donor
and the appearance, that's why I argue Supreme Court and why I believe deeply, the appearance of corruption, whether it is corruption or not, that appearance has been found constitutionally to be able to be regulated by limits for good reasons, very good reasons. And I mean, you almost get blurred to it. You turn on you flip to the webpage of the Ethics Commission now, and you run down that thing, and he's like $50,000, $100,000 checks to state reps and state senators.
Got a couple $1 million checks.
I mean, it's incredible. Everybody's kind of getting dulled to it, but that stuff affects elections dramatically. Yeah. And so overall, yeah, perhaps $70 million is too much, but you can't stop First Amendment rights.
Yeah.
If your household wants to put up a big neon sign in the front yard, you know, vote for your son for mayor or whatever he wants to run for in 30 years, you can do that. You can spend $1 million on a neon sign in your front yard. That's First Amendment independent expenditure rights.
You know that Bebom is running for mayor right now as a 2.5-year-old, of course.
But as a lawyer, okay, because and the fact that you were before the Supreme Court, are you concerned at all?
Should, as a lawyer, I comment about a 2.5-year-old running, or should I just skip
No,
that?
No. Yeah, I'm ignoring the Bebom thing, but partly because I'm a grandmother and I didn't want to talk about my 9-month-old. But
I think he'd be a better sheriff, but that's just me. I think he's
yeah, in his Spider-Man uniform. But as a lawyer, though, when you're looking at some of the provisions in Amendment 2. Are you concerned at all? I mean, I know they've got a severability clause in there, but are you concerned at all that a lot of it might end up getting tossed out since your former chief of staff is prepared to soon file a suit once it's passed, you know, on behalf of some of the critics because of some of the provisions in it? Are you concerned about that? I mean, just we're just talking
I'm
about...
I'm far more concerned about the fact that we don't have limits and... that it's been almost 10 years since we had a plebiscite on it.
Okay. Mm.
Having a public vote and showing everybody how much folks support limits is important. It can affect, even if portions of this are whittled away, it will send yet another clear and strong signal That limits are an important part of a broader ethics package that we need to continue to move forward on.
So we're going to look a bit more retrospectively. It seems like it was just yesterday that I was at your one of your first press conferences as governor-elect. You were appointing Kelvin Simmons as Office of Administration Director. A lot has changed in 8 years, and I wanted to talk in some detail, but also broad strokes about what it's like to be governor during a pretty long period of time. So let's talk about kind of the things that you felt you accomplished and what you felt like you didn't accomplish. I'm going to just ask you pretty simply, and I'm sure you're going to tell me in detail.
I'll try to go a couple and then we can
basically the best of times and the worst of
times. I want to know what you feel were the biggest accomplishments that the legislature passed and you signed or you spearheaded that occurred during your governorship.
Well, I think one thing just before we get into that,
sure.
I do think that people tend to analogize the legislature to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And in our system of government, the governor is much more governmentally powerful.
Yes.
The economic development tools are yours. The appointment tools are yours, many of which don't require advice and consent.
Such as judges.
Judges. It's kind of like when you study civics and you see some of these have strong mayor systems and others. Which
right.
are, and especially on the fiscal end, the Constitution properly gives the governor a significant role there. So the bottom line is I think that there's an overestimation in the public's eyes about the legislature. It's a significant portion. I work with them, and we've gotten a lot done. And I'll go through some of the highlights or lowlights or whatever. But the bottom line is that is a relatively small amount of what you do as governor.
Yes.
Right.
It really is. And I don't mean to say that to minimize. I've served in the legislature. I respect them. I work with them. But I do think that if you're looking at a grade card,
mm-hmm.
Or if you're looking at a way to have history look at you, the vast majority of things that I've been involved in had sometimes you need legislative help, but oftentimes afterwards.
And you can delve into that too, not just legislative, but I think that's an important thing to know
because
I think ordinary people may not know that.
Right.
Because the governor can just unilaterally cut out spending if it's needed to balance the budget.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, we don't print money in the state, so you have to have somebody at the end of the line. And that was especially important in 2009, 2010.
Yes.
And so when you come in, I mean, I had to restrict budget 7 times during the first year. Okay, so all the legislature does is provide appropriation authority, and the money is actually spent through the executive branch.
Right.
And that difference is important, especially on the down end. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of, Jason and Joe, is that we were able to weather the largest recession since the Great Depression. And I was able to downsize government by over 5,100 folks, take $1.5 billion out of the base budgets of our state, and do that in a way that protected our values and protected our institutions and kept us moving forward in a positive progression that has led us to be where we are today, which is much better off on a whole lot of things. So I spent, the bottom line is, to answer your question to start out,
sure.
The first 18 months, I spent an incredible amount of time, energy, and effort balancing the budget and actually balancing it, not passing a bill to balance it, but actually balancing it. Because if you recall, when the stimulus was passed, one of the houses just said, we'll put all the money in, even though it's a 2-year payment. So
right.
you had to make a lot of decisions. And I'm very, very proud that we were able to prioritize and create.
Was it easier to balance the budget in Missouri where you have the Hancock Amendment and the legislature can't just raise taxes without a public vote? Or I know it was challenging because you had to make cuts, but did that make it a little bit easier of a choice that you either have to make cuts or nothing?
Well, when I ran for office, I said I was going to hold the line on taxes. So raising taxes has never been on my list of things to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the Hancock Amendment is just it's out there, and whatnot. It's a law. I don't mean to say it's not there, but when I ran, I told the public in the state of Missouri that you pay and I will. I've cut taxes a couple of times, which I thought could add jobs, and they have. Quite frankly, getting rid of the franchise tax, getting rid of the tax on veterans' pensions so we can attract more veterans. We've now hired almost 8,500 veterans on our Show Me Heroes program in Missouri that are here because of that. The bottom line, that and a few other things. The bottom line is that I didn't really, the Hancock Amendment didn't really have that much to do with it because when I ran, I said I'm going to hold the line on taxes. So I didn't come to the table saying, how can I get more revenue?
But when you ran, there was a number of things that you were hoping to do. You had talked about restoring the Medicaid cuts that were made in 2005 which you had said for years.
We have added 100,000 kids to Medicaid since I've been governor,
yeah,
through the executive branch. That's once again, that's something that a lot of folks missed. You can run things and go and run things better. And because of that, today 100,000 kids have health care that wouldn't have had it before.
And the asset limit went up. That bill that you signed earlier this year was something that I think the legislature had been haggling over for years, which they finally got done, which I think is going to make a difference in everyday lives.
It would make it be a lot cheaper if we passed full Medicaid expansion. So instead of paying 60-40 money on it, we had 90-10 or 95-10 on the match. I sound like an accountant in chief here. But the bottom line is that if we would have passed Medicaid expansion, we would have blown over that asset limit a long time ago, and we would have been in a situation to provide both begin the process of the transformation of better health care.
So, I mean, well, keeping in line with that, then, because the General Assembly refused to do any sort of Medicaid expansion and was even trying to, you know, block the state running its own exchange and some other things, how big of a loss do you think that was economically to the state? And do you think, I mean, even if somehow a Missouri program is created under whoever's the next governor, they're still not going to get those 3 years of free money back. I mean, that's gone. I'm just interested.
Well, 90-10 is a pretty good match. So, I mean, highways are 75-25. I mean, the fact that this legislature has decided that Missourians should pay taxes, we should send them to Washington, D.C., and then we should let Washington, D.C. spend those money for health care in other states, I think is bad policy. And I think the politics got in the way. Nobody would have really a significant substantive discussion with us about the underlying fiscal or health care issues. I think that drawing that money back, not having Missouri be a donor state and billions of dollars a year to other states, is going to help both our economy as well as the health care of our state when it ultimately passes.
Well, I mean, I recall in 2009 when you put forward a proposal that would have the hospitals pay for a fairly modest Medicaid expansion.
It was $35,000 added.
And I don't even think there was any state money that went into there, yet the legislature still rejected it. Because it was, I mean, there was environmental things, like the ACA was being debated then, and maybe there was a political overtone. But the fact that they didn't even do that, wasn't that a pretty bad sign when you eventually proposed, you know, Medicaid expansion under the ACA, that it just wasn't going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, obviously if folks don't want to take money that doesn't come out of general revenue and spend it for health care, that's not a good sign as to whether if that becomes more money, it's going to happen. But once again, I think this whole thing is the problems here have been political, not substantive, not like health care substantive.
Did that surprise you? Because I remember, you know, covering you when you first ran in 2008 and you had plans just like Obama had plans. And of course, when you took office, all of a sudden there was all this economic issues. And instead, you had to spend at least a year and a half dealing with what to cut instead of adding anything that you had hoped to add. So did that kind of change your whole outlook?
I will say, as we got into the second year, though, we did some really good stuff. That's the year we passed the manufacturing bill that allowed us to get the autos. And we got the pension things fixed during that time frame, too. But
I mean, did it change your mindset over how you were going to have to approach things? Economic downturn and
absolutely.
Everything?
I mean, because we focused on getting people back to work, getting training. And at the same time, I took $1.5 billion out and down 5,100 employees. We put 52% more in for worker training. And we did a lot for community colleges. We had Mo Health wins and Mo Manufacturing wins. We needed to get people weren't working. We needed to get them trained. So we did some really dramatic stuff to get people in community colleges and colleges at that time and worker training to make sure that when folks had their downtime, that when they came back to the workforce, they were going to be stronger. So we were focused on all that. But when you don't have money in a state that doesn't print money, it limits some of the decisions you're going to be able to make.
And this is an observation that I made. I think in your first 2 years, you had two leaders of the legislature, Ron Richard and Charlie Shields, who I think you forged pretty good relationships with both. And I think that allowed you to get a lot of things done, not only the budgetary things, but the pension and manufacturing.
Well, they were participants.
Yeah.
You know, they were not commentators.
And that was what I was
they were
saying.
Not. I mean, they're politicians, but they enjoyed the craft of legislating. And they kind of enjoyed perhaps one of them more as an expert on policy than the other, certain areas of policy. Charlie Shields now, for example, I appointed him. He's chairman of the state Board of Education.
Right.
They like to. We then went through a phase where the Senate had its meltdown. They couldn't flip a coin to see who was going to be the pro tem. You get a different speaker that kind of was more of a commentator, very political, kind of outside in.
Which one?
Jones.
Yeah.
I thought you were talking about Tilly for a second.
No, Tilly liked to do deals. Yeah. We got a lot done with Tilly.
I kind of got the sense that he was also serious about – he was very political in some sense, but I also thought he also was very policy-oriented, too.
Tilly and I got along really, really well. I mean, it didn't always agree, but we got along well. And, you know, a little bit of a poker player with you sometimes, you know, in the sense of how you work with things. But that's okay. I mean, I got a pretty tall stack on my side of the table. So.
But you're right. During that time, the Senate was just in the throes of kind of leadership. Crisis,
yeah, I mean, when you flip a coin to decide who's going to be the pro tem, and then the other side is constantly still fighting them on the Republican side, they were having a hard time. I will say here on this program that and I saw him down in the Boot Hill this last weekend. When Rob Mayer was chairman of Appropriations, the first year, you look at the budget passed by the House, way too much. Didn't even try to really cut anything. Right. Rob Mayer got serious and was very helpful and did some really good public policy work. He actually stepped up. Remember Charlie set the Senate down for a couple of days, that rebooting government stuff. Those guys took seriously the responsibility to try to work together. Yeah. Now, I had to do more than they did, but the attitude over there was helpful. Ron and Charlie were people that I work with and continue to get along.
The reason I mentioned that is because after the 2010 election cycle, it seemed like the legislature became much more adversarial with you, and oftentimes you had to play a lot more defense. Not always. I know you passed a lot of major bills, second injury fund changes and whatnot, but it did seem like
283 times my veto's been sustained.
Yeah.
283 times. That's a lot.
Yeah.
I've won. And I've had to fight on some big ones.
Yeah.
Some really big ones. And I had to spend an entire summer on 253, Kansas tax cuts. We would not be where that's it. And then the next summer, I had to spend summer on Friday favors. So there was $2 billion
Right to work.
$2 billion worth of tax cuts with not a single job created, just an experiment. And it's not working out that well in Kansas that I had to turn votes on. And I was successful in both of them. I mean, when you. People say that's impossible to do, to get the other party to switch on a tax cut bill to take the summer and do that. So I had two summers doing that, two in a row that were both successful, and that's $2 billion, and we're a low-tax state already. Now, they passed 509, which I think is a mistake, but that's neither here nor there. The bottom line is that whether that was confrontational or not, that didn't have anything really for me to do, whether somebody was a Democrat or Republican. Mm-hmm. That's just I thought it was the wrong policy for the state, and I put a lot of energy in it.
Now, looking at Brownback,
successfully,
I mean,
too.
Your counterpart in Kansas and all those tax cuts that they did and the economic problems and budget problems they've had, I know nobody wants to feel happy about somebody else's but is that in some ways back up your point from when you were arguing against some of those massive cuts early on when
Brownback
someone
has had the largest tax cut in Kansas history and the largest tax increase to try to make up for. Now, they don't talk about the tax increase they had to do later that didn't get it all done either. So that sort of unpredictable environment and not funding of colleges, not funding of schools. They had an $800 million interest-only loan that they took out as a government, an interest-only loan. I mean, $800 million, and it didn't come public until like a year later. The bottom line is that's why they've been downgraded, why we remain the highest-rated state as far as credit rating. We spend a lot of time doing that. I spend a fair amount of my time having to sit in New York and get cross-examined by young guys with suspenders on to graduate from Wharton. All the rating agencies. You spend your time getting as you do these bond issues and whatnot. I think that the mistakes they've made in Kansas are pretty clear.
So I want to transition into kind of leadership through crisis, and I want to ask about something that this came to mind. You were governor when a statewide official died, and you had to appoint a new state auditor. I'd like to get your sense of how you dealt with that situation and what your reaction was, because we don't really talk about the death of Tom Schweik that often, but I'm going to be honest here. It's personally affected me because the manner of his death, the fact that he committed suicide, was deeply troubling to me. And I really liked him as a person, and I'm sad almost every day the fact that he's gone. I would like to hear your insight into your perspective on it, because not only was it emotionally wrenching, you had to actually make a decision who the next state auditor was.
Right. It was a personal tragedy for all of us in this difficult avocation we've chosen, where there is a lot of give and take, and your life is out there in public.
So, and I had just seen him a couple of days before.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it remains one of those. And I, quite frankly, I thought when you first opened that up, the other time that happened was when we lost Governor Carnahan. Yeah.
Right.
I was Attorney General at the time. That was one of the very difficult time. Both of those were difficult, different situations.
Yes.
But so my mentality was to try to stabilize the office, try to give confidence in the office real quickly. So I appointed a temporary auditor. I think when I appointed John Watson, my chief of staff, I think everybody understood John's one of these folks that is a good, honest broker and is going
right.
to handle the office well
right,
and do
right,
it well.
Because right.
I wanted to have enough time to make what I thought was a good long-term decision for the state. And I think at that point, all of us were emotionally reacting as opposed to structurally reacting. You on the press, me on my end. So the first thing I did was appointed an acting auditor, so that then I could have a process to look at a number of candidates and see what I thought the best step forward was for the state. So I, like everybody else, took a little bit of a just like a jump stop for 6 or 7 weeks to then get a process in place to make a significant appointment for a constitutional office.
And you ended up choosing Nicole Galloway, and there was some pressure on you to appoint an African-American, I'm sure that you knew, but I know that there's a lot of people who think you made an excellent choice with Nicole Galloway, but why did you decide to choose her?
Well, there was a pressure from a lot of folks to appoint a lot of people. You get a free statewide office without the necessity of election. That's a rare plum for folks, especially one of the offices where you clearly have an opportunity later on to move up. I'd appointed her to two other positions. I had appointed her to the Missouri Technology Corporation, but before that, I had appointed her county treasurer in Boone County after you had the death of a treasurer there. So she had been through that. She's really, really smart, and just honest as the day is long. And she was on my list really early on, because I was kind of committed to trying to bring in the next generation.
Mm. Well, you know, in fact, that's what I was going to ask.
If
you intentionally had been looking for somebody.
Yeah, I really was. I mean, I thought that this is somebody who I wanted to get a commitment that they would run for reelection for that office. I didn't want them to jump too soon, but I wanted to choose somebody that I thought could be a great leader for a long time, and that. The other thing, it brought good core competency to that position, and I think that she does. So as we went through the various interviews and whatnot, it whittled down. She continued to rise up and score the best, and very proud of that appointment. I think she'll do a great job.
We'll see if she gets reelected.
She'll have another kid.
Yeah.
Now, one of the other crises, I think, you know, is obviously Joplin. And, I mean, I remember being with you at the airport after Lambert got hit with all the tornadoes and stuff. I mean, these natural disasters, there are no plans for. I mean, they just kind of happen. I was interested, I mean, now that you're looking back as far as the whole Joplin, that awful tragedy, just kind of what was going through your mind during all this? How did you hear about it? And then, of course, you were down there, and you got actually pretty decent marks for your handling of that. Any thoughts? I mean, as you look back on that,
How I heard about it was interesting. I mean, I usually go down and try to on Sunday evenings. I've got an elliptical downstairs with a TV in the mansion, and I try to work out around 5:15 so I can see the end of the NFL games and see the the end of the game show.
So no, you know, podcast.
It's kind of the spot. Well, I mean,
playing poker when that happened.
Well, but you get to see. At the end of Sunday, they show you a little bit from all the games, rather than sitting there watching the games all the time, you get to see the whole thing. And then Sunday nights is a work night for me as you prepare for the next week.
Right.
So I got on the down there a little early that night, and Ted Ardini called. The council called at about 5 till 5. That tornado hit at 5:21, so called before the tornado and said, "There's a weather pattern coming at Joplin that's really dangerous. You might want to flip to the Weather Channel. Something might happen." So we're watching. I mean, we watch this stuff. I mean, there's part of me that feels like you're the state weatherman. So I was extremely aware and saw that, you know, watched that. We were then pretty much, I didn't leave that office. It's an office down in the basement. Didn't leave that office till 12 or 1 o'clock that night, just working right there on a number of things. We had to get communications down there. We had to get a bunch of things done, and I couldn't get down there that night. The weather was too bad. I was down there, obviously, the next day. I was down there 10 of the first 11 days. I was there 75 of the first 90 days I was in Joplin. So Joplin kind of stands as a large one, but I think it's important to put Joplin in context for just 1 second. That's why it's great to have a little more time here.
Okay.
2011, our state emergency management was up 245 days. The tornado you mentioned was New Year's. We also that year had to close I-70, first and only time that's ever happened because of snow.
Yeah,
and I
want
to thank the Missourians that helped us. I mean, look what happened in Atlanta when they had to close the road a little bit. So kids were having to sleep in buses. We had everybody between basically west of St. Louis to Independence. They were all housed that night safely and taken care of. We also had the tornado in Sedalia. Bird's Point was blown up down to Boot Heel in April. Where the Corps of Engineers blew up and flooded half a county. We had 68 levees we lost in northwest Missouri. That's why I was up there yesterday going through that. And then you had the Joplin tornado. So we were fully operational the entire year on significant emergency management. And I think got high marks for it. The bottom line with Joplin was bigger than the rest of them. And for those that don't kind of recall the numbers, just real quick, a rundown of those numbers, 161 killed, 1,100 hospitalized, 11,000 cars wiped out, 7,550 houses, 9 schools, 765 businesses damaged significantly, about 650 of those completely destroyed. What we were concerned about from day one was that we'd lose a town. Hospital hit, wiped out, obviously, 2,200 jobs right there. So from day one, we were trying to give people down there the strength to rebuild and to put the organization around it. At one point, we had 405 law enforcement agencies down there. Remember Tim Fitch, the former chief here, was directing traffic. Yeah. One day I passed Tim down there because he said, I'm down here taking orders. Let's go.
It's just unimaginable. And I've been to Joplin a couple of times when I was in college. It's a wonderful place. It's very prosperous. It's close to the Arkansas border. So I think economically it's been doing really well. I still think it is. But that it must be an enormous challenge after a weather pattern of that magnitude causes that much damage to such a big town, basically.
Yeah, I mean, Tuesday morning, Lane and Roberts and I, who's now DPS director, we walked the tornado route this week. We started out before dawn up at the park that's now, not Cunningham Park, but the other side,
right,
where the hospital was. And we walked the route of that tornado, started before dawn, and then we went down to Carthage. We were doing a safe room announcement down there. It was really moving emotionally in a lot of ways. The unemployment rate there is lower than it was at the time. The population is the highest it's ever been. When school started August 17th of that year, 98.4% of the kids were back in school. We built a school in 56 days in a mall, the high school. We built a middle school at a factory. We just pulled out every stop you can pull out and really proud of the effort there.
Are there any lessons that you took away from that either maybe things that didn't go smoothly that you would do next time or just things that worked out well that you think, well, we need to remember how we did this so if something like this happens again, we can duplicate that?
Well, we took over the death notification side of that. And, you know, after a while, there was misinformed numbers about how many people were missing. They said 1,500 people, and we knew it wasn't that number. We had to take that over. So I just think that in a mass casualty situation like that, where the bodies are really damaged too, it's really hard to identify folks. The bottom line is we probably that part of it, I think, would be part of what we do now. And that's why we've now got assets for what we call our DMORT to deal with issues like that.
So
that's one. There's 100 things I could say, but that's one of them. Also, the management of nonprofit resource, really important. We had 180,000 volunteers from all 50 states work down there over the next 12 months. That's a pretty amazing thing to do that safely and organize it was something that I think the nation is watching and is continuing to watch how we did that. And we're continue to get a lot of calls on how to organize mass volunteers.
Really?
So I want to ask, where were you when you found out Michael Brown was shot and killed?
I was in the mansion and picked up the Sunday Post-Dispatch and saw the picture on the front page. So it was Sunday.
So what was your reaction when you saw that?
First of all, unfortunately, from a lot of different sources, murders happen in a state.
Yeah.
And generally, the chief executive is not in a command control issue about investigations or whatever. That one had a different feel to it because the fact there that that drew my attention, not just the cop and young man. That's obviously a challenge. But the fact that the body lay there for 4.5 hours. I mean, and the mother was in essence prevented from the opportunity. I mean, you can only imagine as a parent, if regardless of what the fact pattern is, I mean, if you can literally see your son or daughter laying in the street and you're unable to interact, it seemed to me like things were supposed to. So at about 9:20 on Monday morning, I picked up the phone and talked with County Executive Dooley, his senior team, and indicated that at that point I was going to reach out to the Department of Justice and ask for a dual investigation at the same time.
Now, by that time, the protests were pretty
there
well
had been,
underway.
There, not only protests, there had been riots, and the Quick Trip was burned down, and many businesses were vandalized. But continue.
Yeah.
On Sunday evening.
Right.
So, yes, from the first time I saw. The bottom line is I saw it that Sunday. We saw what happened Sunday night, and Monday morning, first thing, 9 a.m., I'm on the phone, and then on the phone to the Justice Department saying, let's do dual investigations so we have independent done at the same time.
So you've been asked about Ferguson a lot. I mean, it's going to be part of your legacy, good or bad. And we've asked you specific questions about why you did this decision or X decision. I'm more interested in how difficult it was to be the governor during this crisis, because you obviously got a lot of criticism, rightly or wrongly, but it also just seemed like, from my perspective, and this is why I asked you right before the grand jury decision, what do you say to the people who say that government has failed and how courts have failed? It just seemed like the governmental reaction across the board was disorganized and just wasn't good. I want you to kind of explain what your perspective was.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of local government involvement there. The state was not in command and control on either one of the investigations.
Right.
And at various times, obviously, had to bring in additional coordination resources on the public safety side, which we did. So look back. I mean, what we were doing was, first of all, trying to make sure that didn't happen again. And the fact that throughout all of that, with all the intensity, you didn't have another shooting on either side. A cop wasn't shot by somebody, and a cop didn't shoot anybody else. With all that intensity, shows a lot of discipline.
I think that there were some police officers that were shot from August 9th to November 24th.
Right, but not as part of the protests. There was one running in the back of a room, back behind a building, trying to chase a fugitive.
That's what I'm referring
to. In that area. But as far as the protests,
yes.
There was not.
That was
although
what I was referring
yeah,
to.
That was, like I say, there were other, and you had the other shooting down, I mean, down the city, the fellow with the knife and that sort of stuff. But inside that zone, there was that. So, yeah, I think that it showed some gaps at the local side. But when I talk about Ferguson now, I say three things. We've listened, we've learned, and things are getting better. And I think that, unlike a lot of other areas, the simplest thing would have been to be done with this, back away from it, and say we don't have a responsibility both to the region and the country to try to find some long-term solutions. And instead, I chose to take the more difficult path. That difficult path is not only to be involved personally, but to appoint a commission and then make substantive changes, okay? Whether it's the, ban the box, or the municipal court reform, or the Summer Jobs League, or all of the things that we have done, recruiting businesses to invest there. All it would have been a lot easier for a lot of folks to back off, and I'm really proud of that. The region has said we're going to try to be an example for this, understanding it's a long, hard fight, long, hard trail to get down to make real progress.
That was going to be my next question, and this is something I've focused on a lot. Although municipal, I'm not saying that the municipal court overhaul was by any means insignificant. It's very significant. If you look at other states, when you talk about changes to law enforcement, even red states like Texas, they have gotten a lot farther on changing law enforcement policy than Missouri has, despite the fact that Missouri went through this incredible crisis. But I wanted you to explain
that. I don't want to be critical of the press, especially when you got the microphone and I got this.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
But of the least covered things that we've done, are the changes we've done in police officer standard training.
Okay, you want to talk about
that
a bit?
We're now requiring anti-bias training. We're requiring de-escalation training.
Yes.
We give mental health treatment for cops. Mm-hmm. I mean, I appointed a whole lot of good people on the post commission that went around the state and had hearings. Manuel Cleaver III, Lane Roberts now, was working on it. Some of those things are going to and then mental health training on all sides of that, and upping the amount of training that's required. That sort of stuff is long-term substantial. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what other states have done on the requiring of training, but that's a pretty significant step forward. And you know, that is something that it's you know, that's necessary so that you get best practices, best training, and not unimportant.
Do you think your administration has not gotten some of the credit it deserves for at least some of this?
I mean, there's
this
no
stuff, or is there
when you have issues that involve, you know, race and violence and you know, riots and whatnot. That's really hard to jam that into a good positive moment. You know, I mean, it's a raw moment. It's an expression of deep-seated challenges on a lot of folks' side. What I've been frustrated by is that as if different things have happened across the country, it seems people gravitate towards just the facts of what happened in that case, whether it's in Minnesota or New York or Charlotte or whatever, as opposed to the larger, broader, deeper issues that are really what we got to get at.
Were you disappointed that neither the president nor Hillary Clinton have actually visited Ferguson?
The campaigns are busy. I'm not going to be critical of where they spend their time. They need to win, and where the swing voters are is where both candidates.
But this is the reason I asked that question. I mean, the federal government has Ferguson a consent decree, and I think as the leader of the federal government, I think whoever is the next president should go to Ferguson and talk with the people about how that's going and how they're changing their city. Do you think that's a reasonable expectation?
Sure, that's one place that a president might go. But I think it would have been, if you're going to ask when it's there, I mean, calming people down on the front end to get to a more rational thought earlier would have been also a role that could have been. But it was a hot place, and like I say, not a lot of folks want to be around it.
Now, were you caught off guard when what happened in November when McCullough, you know, announced the grand jury decision, you know, not to indict, and then things got really crazy, you know, and there was a lot of, you know, arson and a lot of stuff that went on that night. And I know you've come under fire for whether or not the National Guard was where they should have been or whatever. Looking back, I mean, is there anything you want to say about that? I mean, this is the November. So here it is, like, what, 3 months later? And
well, I mean, the timing of that on at the time at night like that obviously was not good. I didn't have control over that.
Right.
That's not when you want to do that. I'm not going to sit here and take a whole bunch of time replaying history on that, but it doesn't take any sort of deep analysis to say you shouldn't do it at night and you shouldn't do it on a weekend like that, as far as public safety. But once again, I wasn't in the room making the decision when, and who knows.
Yeah, but you had to deal with the fallout.
Yeah, you bet
of
I
it.
Had to. But as far as the reaction after that, it certainly didn't help us that some of the family members said some pretty outrageous stuff that night. That let's burn the thing down was not what the PSAs that had been prepared. That wasn't the same verbiage. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
But secondarily, we also thought there might be more action in Clayton.
Yes.
I mean, we were concerned that you're going to see, because that's where the decision was made.
Right.
So but we had enough resources out there. The bottom line is there was going to be some action at night, and nobody was significantly hurt. There certainly were some businesses that were down. But once people started shooting guns off, you can't send firefighters into gunfire, guys.
You just cannot. I want to make this point eminently clear.
And I was alive when we had the problems at Kent State.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And,
okay.
And if a it's National Guardsman had lowered an M1 rifle and shot an unarmed African-American in the streets of his own hometown in there to think he was going to stop somebody from breaking a window, that's not a trade you want to make.
I want to make this.
That's just not a trade you want to make. Right. So I dealt directly with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I talked again to General Grass just the other day. I mean, everyone was deeply concerned about that risk. We would be in a much worse place if, you know, Kent State's a long time ago, and we all remember it. Ferguson would be in a much different place if when somebody said they were going to run out and break a window, that the order was there that American soldiers on American soil should shoot American citizens. I was not prepared and I would not give that order, and that was the right decision.
So does that surprise you then that during the Republican primary for governor, all four candidates, you know, made a big deal about saying, you know, there hadn't been enough law and order in Ferguson and they wouldn't allow this or that. I mean, as you're watching this, I mean, because they basically were advocating what you just said would have been tragedy. Did that surprise you?
We had a powder keg there in a lot of ways, and we were trying to, stay calm and not show as much strength. What you want to do is you don't want it to have an army overtake things. So the bottom line is none of those folks had the information I had. They didn't have the intelligence that I had. They weren't where we were. And they're entitled in a campaign to say whatever they want. I disagree with a lot of what was said by them because they were uninformed, and plus they had a political bent to what they were talking about. And what I was doing had nothing to do with politics. It was public safety, and it was making sure we got through that. And sure, we lost a few buildings, and that's yeah. bad, but we didn't lose people, and that's good.
And this is what I was trying to say, and I apologize for interrupting during your answer, but I think what you just said is eminently reasonable. Buildings can be rebuilt. If someone shoots and kills somebody, not only is there more of a legacy, I mean, somebody's dead. I mean, that's unimaginable. My question to you is, you called a state of emergency about a week ahead of time. I don't have the text in front of you, but I'm just wondering if by calling a state of emergency that early, did it give the impression that you were also going to protect property as well?
Perhaps, but and we did protect a lot of property.
Right. Yes.
I mean, that's one thing. I'm not going to go through the full operational plan, but
exactly.
But when the power went out in Ferguson, that was because somebody attacked a tower and knocked down the power.
Mm-hmm.
So we were guarding every bit of the electric grid in this area.
Yes.
We had folks guarding every fire station in case folks had to be out. We had medevacs there in case there were situations where people had problems. So you bet we were guarding a lot of property.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And the essential assets of the community stayed intact. Mm-hmm. We're not dealt with and lost. We lost an AutoZone, and I don't mean to minimize that in any way, shape, or form. But when you look at the context of the size of the scope of where this could be, the city and the county, and the breadth of where things were going on, folks running around that are that upset are going to find something to hit.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's why I wanted to be very careful with my preface, because as I said before, lives cannot be replaced. I've noticed a lot of businesses have reopened.
Now, here it is 2 years later, and we're still talking about it.
Burning up the time on all my great legacy stuff.
Talking about it. But as you say, many times when you start stepping back without judging who was right or who was wrong, the fact that there was no loss of life during all that, you mentioned that you've had some talks lately. I mean, in Washington and other places, is there sort of a revised judgment of how you and others performed in the wake of the fact that nobody was killed?
I think the movie's made, and I think the national press decided that they wanted to cover it in a certain way. I mean, the frustrating part to me is that you had certain people saying I wasn't around when hadn't been there, and that's just not true. I mean, it's not even close to true, and quite frankly, the people that were saying that—
They weren't around.
Well, a state senator was around, but to say that I wasn't there when I'm on the horn on Monday morning with them in the Justice Department, when I'm at a community meeting Tuesday night in Tracy
Blackman's—
when
you're being yelled at at a press conference.
Yeah, community meeting in Tracy Blackman's church on Tuesday when I've been by the place where Michael Brown laid and had a picture of that on my Twitter account during the first few days and all that sort of stuff. For people to say I wasn't there is just— and to repeat that— that part of it's a challenge.
So we only have a few minutes left, but I do want to touch upon your political legacy, because one of the things that I've noticed in the description of this U.S. Senate race is they're painting Missouri as like this impenetrable red fortress that's too Republican to elect a statewide Democrat. Now, here we have as our guest somebody who's been elected to statewide office
six times.
You were elected governor, I think, double digits both times. Against two credible opponents. Kenny Holzhoff, credible opponent, was seen as a very promising political figure. You beat him by, what, 19 points, 20
Something
points?
Like that, yeah.
Dave Spence, it was a self-funding candidate who spent a lot of money, a very impressive business background. I think you beat him by less, but you still beat him by a lot. So regardless of what people think about your decisions, it's obviously you were very successful from that end. I guess this is your chance
in
to
the Missouri voters, obviously.
So I guess this is your chance to spike the football and explain why. But I mean, that is part of your political legacy that you were personally very successful.
You have had huge majorities in most of your statewide elections from 92 on. Any thoughts? Well, 92 was close, but from 96 on. So, I mean, thoughts about why? I mean, obviously, a lot of the voters liked you, and they liked what you did. What do you think, I mean, when you look at that, and what lessons does that provide for other Democrats?
Well, I would indicate that my thought is that they still show a lot of respect for us, and I appreciate, as you see kind of on the numbers, they continue to rise. I mean, as far as like, but I don't spend a lot of time looking at that sort of stuff and not doing a lot of polling. I think there's three basic reasons. First of all, I committed to campaign and to govern in all parts of our state.
Okay.
I mean, I didn't try to approach this as I'm going to go to just the Democrat areas or Republican areas. So in campaigns and in service, I go everywhere. I mean, I don't try to stay in the office and make people come to me. I think that's really important because people tell you stuff when you're out in their community that they'll never tell you. So taking a position in which I'm going to spend time in rural areas. I'm going to spend time in Republican areas. I'm going to spend time in Democrat in all sorts of communities. First of all, that. Number two, I work really hard. Guys, I mean, we're in a world in which hard work pays off. And I get up early and I stay late. And I think people know that. I think they appreciate that. And number three, I just don't approach things in an overly political way. I, that's not interesting to me. When people come at you and they say, I'm a Democrat, so, or I'm a Republican, so, what they're getting ready to do is say they can't prove it, so they the reason they hold this position is because what party they are. That's just not interesting to me, and I've always been somebody who approached it. Plus, I think when I was Attorney General and State Senator and as Governor, average working people out there know that I understand their challenges and that I've been consistent and I've taken the high road. The other thing is I've taken the high road. I have not been a guy. What's the old line? You take the high road, there's less traffic up there. people come after me all the time. People say all sorts of stuff. I mean, I'm sure these candidates say stuff. You ask me what some of these guys in the Republican primary said about this or that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mean to say I don't care, but I don't really care. You know, I mean, my job is to serve 6.2 million Missourians, not to be. I remember right after I got elected, I mean, the people would say stuff and they'd come in and say, oh, this is a good quip to come back at them. I've just been disappointing to you all the entire time as governor
You've had some good quips.
Back.
But at the same time, while you've been personally successful, the legislature has become extremely Republican. Some rural parts of the state, like Northeast Missouri, Central Missouri, and Southeast Missouri, which are historically Democratic, have gone deep red. And that has to be part of your political legacy, even if it's part of a national trend. Why do you think that happened? Because the fact that Northeast Missouri has nobody in the legislature anymore is shocking to me.
Oh, we're seeing that's why Trump's here now. I mean, they've been pretty effective at the use of wedge issues.
Okay.
Dividing people is a very good political strategy. And that's what they've done. And it's played out. And they've with no limits, they've parliamentarized elections, too, so that you're in those areas. But, those are counties that I've won.
So when you look back over everything, what are the things that you want people to remember you for? I mean, you know, aside from the fiscal,
we've been incredibly fiscally disciplined. And the education front, our schools are much more well-funded. The bottom line is we're up 36% in college graduates in 4 years. We're up 44% in 2 year graduates. In the mental health system, we've made some incredible investments with the autism mandate, with the new mental hospital, with our Partnership for Hope, with our mental health liaisons. We've made huge. And then on the advanced manufacturing sector, we've added 26,000 advanced manufacturing sector jobs since 2010. We now have these two huge auto plants that I personally negotiated those deals, called the legislature in for a special session to get. And we've done all that while maintaining our fiscal discipline.
Well, Governor, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming to do our show and talking for an hour about your legacy. Even though I'm sure that Joe and I have had back and forth with you overall, I immensely respect the office of the governorship, just as I respect Matt Blunt and Bob Holden and yourself. And I just want to let you know that. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter, Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. It's JManNIES.
And you can follow the governor on Gov Jay Nixon. Do you actually look at your Twitter account?
Absolutely. I approve every one.
Oh, my gosh.
Every single one. There's nothing out there that... everyone.
Oh, and we always have closeout music. So we were going to ask you, what's your favorite song? So we can stick that here at the end.
Well, it's it'd be good to finish with the boss. Well, Born to Run wouldn't hurt.
Thank you very much. And he has to run. So long.